Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. A focused installation on the work of American artist Barbara Kruger, born in 1945, will reopen the East Building Tower Gallery after the space's nearly 3 years of renovation. Inspired by the gallery's recent acquisition of Kruger's untitled Know Nothing, Believe Anything, Forget Everything, 1987-2014, the exhibition comprises related images of figures in profile over which Kruger has superimposed her striking figures of speech. The distinctive direct address of Kruger's text using active verbs and personal pronouns contrasts with her selected images of passive figures to create arresting conceptual works of great visual power. In this lecture, held on October 23, 2016, at the National Gallery of Art, Molly Donovan introduces the exhibition In the Tower, Barbara Kruger, on view through January 22, 2017.
I am so delighted to speak with you today about the exhibition In the Tower, Barbara Kruger. The space in which the show is featured was, until very recently, the only tower space, and it's now joined by two other towers. But it is still distinct because it is the only space in which we have rotating exhibitions of modern masters and living artists. And after having been closed for the renovation, this show, the first in 3 years, renews our commitment to the art of the present and the enduring support of our Tower Project donor group members. And we're most grateful to them for their support and their patience waiting for this show to open, and I want to thank them once again. This exhibition, I didn't realize until very recently, is the first thematic exhibition of Barbara Kruger's work. That was a surprise, because I think of her work as being so well known, but many of her works are installations that she designs entirely on her own, and I would call out the wonderful installation at the Hirshhorn Museum, one of her room wraps that is so fantastic. So what you see in our tower presentation is something different. It is a slice of her work that was conceived by me, but based on a recent acquisition. And first, I want to just explain that there are 15 works in the show, and they range from the monumental, and by that I'm referring to this 55-foot wide, 23-feet high wall work that she made specifically for the methodology of the exhibition. And the theme of the show, of which I'm speaking, is the profile, her profile works. And here we have a very large woman in profile, over which are installed three discrete works on vinyl. And she came to the exhibition space over a year ago, saw it for the first time, and responded as she would as an artist who is so attuned to architectural spaces. And she says that is her first love. I would argue she has a lot of other talents as well, but she very much understands design and space like no one else. So this exhibition with these monumental and medium-scaled works also go all the way down to magazine size. She's an artist who works in every scale and many mediums. And this is a testament to her broad spectrum of presentation in the world. She likes for her work to be seen by a wide, large audience, and this is one way to do it, through print materials. And so there's this case with some of these ephemeral materials that feature works in profile, and I'll go through those more specifically as we go through. The show was inspired by this recent acquisition. It is a figure in profile, an image that she would have selected likely from a medical journal or a medical advertisement of a woman lying prostrate and receiving a medical treatment to her eye, black and white, characteristic Kruger. and with these red bands slicing across the image, dividing it in half, reading, know nothing, believe anything, forget everything. And this work really set up the thesis for the show, which presents figures or faces in profile and looking off the picture plane, the two-dimensional picture plane. And these figures, these images are coupled with the direct address text that comes straight out at the viewer. So this tension that these works, these profile works, create. Just to thank a few people, this show wouldn't have been possible without a lot of support and help, certainly from Harry Cooper, department head, and several colleagues who helped me research the works, dig deep, look carefully at these works in the show, find them, obtain them for loan. And I wanted to thank especially Jennifer Roberts, Paige Rosansky, and Terrence Washington. Thank you so much. I also want to thank my colleagues at the Hirshhorn with whom I've talked about Kruger's work, and my colleagues at the National Portrait Gallery with whom I discussed the parameters of the profile and its history. And most of all, I want to thank Barbara Kruger, a remarkable artist who gave voice and vision through her works to me and so many other viewers. This acquisition, going back to the work at hand here, I want to thank the Collectors Committee for enabling its acquisition, and importantly, additional donors helped us buy this work, members of the Collectors Committee, and the charge was led by Sharon Rockefeller and her husband Jay, joined by Howard and Roberta Amundson, Denise and Andrew Saul, Lenny and Bernie Greenberg, Agnes Gund, and Michelle Smith. So as I said, it is an image, a found image, coupled with Kruger's direct address text. And as the artist has said of the profile works, it puts into question or crisis the status of the image and the status of the text in their combination form. And that is important for the future looking at these slides as I'm going to present them to you. And I want to lay out certain specifics of Kruger's environment that informed her work as an artist, and I do this with full respect and knowledge that the subject of her work that she draws on is nonspecific, in it drawing on the commonplace and the stereotypes that she calls into question in her work. So I'm going to frame her work, and then I'll try to show how she unframes and sets into play an entire body of work that is as relevant today is when she began making these works in the 1980s. And I'll also discuss how Kruger's profile works figure into the larger arc of history. Kruger was born in Newark, New Jersey in 1945 during the golden age of picture magazines like Life and Look and the advent of television and grand Hollywood movies that were all competing for attention, and Kruger took it all in. And we can see the parallels between the visual vocabulary of a magazine like Life magazine would have on Kruger's choice of black and white images and these white letters on red ground for text. Her higher education began at Syracuse University and continued at Parsons School of Art and Design in New York, where she studied in 1966 with Martin Israel and Deanne Arbus, who told the young Kruger she should write because she talked like Dorothy Parker. Beginning in 1967, Kruger worked as a layout editor at Condé Nast for 9 years, including a post at Mademoiselle magazine, where she began laying out the section of the back of the magazine. And here I show you an example. I can't show you here that on the masthead, it's kind of hard to read, but Kruger's name is, whoops. Let's see, up here. And she quickly rose to the position of chief layout editor within 1 year at the tender age of 19. And you'll notice that the imagery in these layouts is photographic. This is important. For according to Melissa Banta, a curator of a 2010 exhibition at the Harvard Business School, beginning in the 1930s, there was a sense that advertising could help inspire faith in the economy, and companies used photography as an effective means to project confidence in both the production and the sale of consumer goods. And so for those 9 years working for Condé Nast Publications, Kruger worked inside the world of commercial imagery, and it was all business. As Kruger has said of her job there, if your page didn't grab the viewer's attention, you were fired. In the early 1970s, photographic advertisements became the subject of the 20th century's most noted social scientist, Irving Goffman, who in 1979 published his study entitled Gender Advertisements, in which he categorized ads according to pose and wrote about their gendered structure. In his introduction, Goffman writes, there are instructional pictures as found, say, in medical texts, the figures in them intended to be anonymous, serving only, apparently, as illustrations of what can be visited on man. And this last statement really calls to mind Kruger's overarching concern, which is to make art about how we are to one another. And so looking at Kruger and looking back at this work by Goffman, we realize that Kruger herself is in many ways an anthropologist, mining the data from the print advertisements and identifying types, including her profiles. And since you can't read this fine print, we have with the feminine touch under that heading, Goffman's description, women more than men are pictured using their fingers and hands to trace the outlines of an object or cradle it to caress its surface. This ritualistic touching is to be distinguished from the utilitarian kind that grasps, manipulates, or holds. And then under function ranking, the way images are constructed to convey function and ranking, in our society, when a man and a woman collaborate face-to-face in an undertaking, the man, it would seem, is likely to perform the executive role, providing only that one can be fashioned. This arrangement seems widely represented in advertisements, in part, no doubt, to facilitate interpretability at a glance. So we go from Goffman's gendered structures in the 70s, this is just all part of a piece that I've pulled out to tell Kruger's story. We go to Laura Mulvey's gendering of viewers, theorized in her essay, Visual Pleasure and Narrative Cinema from 1975. And since this is a theory, I'm illustrating it with an image here, a still of Ira Levin's thriller, The Stepford Wives, also from 1975, a film that concerns a feminist movement in suburban Connecticut where all the women are killed by their husbands and replaced by obedient robotic replicas. And it's a film about the women's movement in the 1970s. But back to Mulvey, who wrote, in a world ordered by sexual imbalance, pleasure in looking has been split by active male and passive female. And in this dynamic, all viewers are gendered as male when looking at representations of females, of the signifiers of beauty and pleasure. And Catherine Ross here in the Stepford Wives still starts out as a woman who is a photographer, so she's gendered as male here, and then meets her fate. Mulvey is important for this discussion. She goes on to explain more about the figure and in the figure as it's represented in film, which could also apply to two-dimensional imagery as well. She states, one part of the fragmented body destroys the Renaissance space, the illusion of depth demanded by the narrative. It gives flatness, the quality of a cutout or icon, rather than verisimilitude to the screen. And Maltby's statement about the fragmented body in film is equally important, as I said, when you're considering two-dimensional surfaces, works of art that are on two-dimensional surfaces, which are already flattened. And this is an important point when you're considering Kruger's choice of the profile, a format that fragments and flattens the face and the figure. And Mulvey ends her piece by saying, it is that analyzing pleasure or beauty, it is said that analyzing pleasure or beauty destroys it, and that is the intention of this essay. What makes this makes clear is the trajectory of the so-called first wave of feminist movement is essentially a change narrative, to use a term coined by management consultants. Kruger took these lessons and added to the narrative, and she complicated them as well. In 1969, while working at Condé Nast, she started writing and making her own art. She wrote poetry and film and television reviews, writing these reviews, TV guides for Art Forum magazine that she later compiled in this volume, TV Guides, in 1985. So all this writing reminds us of Helene Sissou, the feminist theoretician's writing in 1976, important breakthrough, entitled The Laugh of the Medusa. It was a manifesto advocating women's writing and self-representation. She said, I shall speak about women's writing, about what it will do. Woman, write herself, must write about and bring women to writing, meaning you only have to look at the Medusa straight on to see her, and she's not deadly. She's beautiful, and she's laughing. By 1979, I'm showing you here a work by Cindy Sherman, a kind of compatriot of Kruger's in the so-called pictures generation. And this work is upstairs in the Meyerhoff-Becker exhibition, so you can see it after the lecture or after you go see the Kruger show. By 1979, Kruger had developed her own picture practice with photographs repurposed from 1940s to 70s manuals and magazines that she overlaid with her own texts, or commonplace phrases that she twists just ever so slightly to decenter and destabilize our understanding. Douglas Crimp, the critic, described the pictures generation as is typical of what has become called postmodernism. This new work is not confined to any particular medium. Instead, it makes use of photography, film, performance, as well as traditional modes of painting, drawing, and sculpture. Picture is used colloquially, is also non-specific. A picture book might be a book of drawings or photographs, and in common speech, a painting, drawing, or print is often simply called a picture. Equally important for my purposes, picture in its verb form can refer to a mental process as well as the production of an aesthetic object. So what I'm showing on the screen and having you focus on while I'm saying all this is one of Kruger's most important works, Your Gaze Hits the Side of My Face, from 1983. And what you're seeing here is Kruger's original paste-up, or in the terms of her layout design profession, a camera-ready copy that she would then go on to photograph and make this work, which is a photograph in a red frame. This work served as inspiration for the critic Craig Owens' 1983 essay, The Medusa Effect. So here we are, Medusa again. And at the time, and the subtitle is important, is this, or the Specular Ruse. And the time that they were made, Kruger's 1980s works powerfully engaged and promoted theoretical discussions of the gaze around the construct of the viewer and the subject of representation. Owen's title refers to the classical myth in which Medusa, in the same reference aforementioned in the Sisu essay, Medusa petrifies all mortals who receive her gaze. And Owens compares Perseus's trick, or the specular ruse, with the mirrored surface of his shield and Kruger's reflection of commonplace images, like the frozen profiled figures in the works of the show, because both control the power of the gaze and representation. And here I'm showing you just some other examples and images of Perseus, the work on the left, the Perseus with the mirrored shield, with the Gorgon reflected in the shield, allowing her to decapitate her. And then a more recent example that is holds true to the original Ovid, this still from Percy Jackson and the Olympians, where Percy Jackson is using the mirrored surface of his iPhone to shield himself from the Gorgon. And what's interesting is that I found these images on a website called tvtropes.org, where if you want to be a writer for television, you can draw on all these different types to construct your narratives. So the idea that these tropes exist online now is kind of interesting and exciting, and that there's a formula to all these representations, that these types are, there's a stronghold of types out in the world and archetypal characters that storytellers draw on. Kruger regards the stereotype as a weapon, an instrument of power, wrote Owens. And this power, he and others would argue, informs systems of government, economy, and sexual identity. The effect of stereotypes then promote passivity, receptivity, and inactivity, exactly what the prone bodies in some of Kruger's work illustrates. By cropping, enlarging, and reorienting her images, Kruger reposes the figure, drawing our attention to the structure of the photographs themselves. In so doing, she releases the profiled figures from their frozen position. And I might add that the pose is also implied in the questions she poses, pun intended, in her direct address texts. So we're not done yet with Medusa. The myth has provided a rich context in which to understand Kruger's work, and many writers and critics have used this myth to put forward their ideas about Kruger and others, Hal Foster among them. He even likens the Gorgon to an artist, and I want to read this for you. On the one hand, the Gorgon is the anti-artist par excellence, the opposite of Pygmalion. She turns animate object bodies into inanimate statues. On the other hand, this very power makes her the master artist, for she produces sculptural images by her gaze alone. So thank you for indulging my Medusa obsession here, but it seems to be central to Kruger's practice overall and to this body of work in particular. And I'm now going to kind of throw my script aside and just walk you through other works in the exhibition that in various ways present different ideas about the profile. This is an early work. It is photographic, like Your Gaze Hits the Side of My Face. What's interesting, and your creation is divine, our reproduction is human, is the text that accompanies this image of a hand drawing the profile of a little girl in a very traditional manner. On the wall text for the exhibition, in the exhibition itself, it was a very interesting moment because as a museum professional, we are very specific about the mediums that we describe in the wall text. And especially photography, and our photography department has worked very hard to make all the photographic mediums understood as specific. However, when you're dealing with an artist who considers her, who is self-termed conceptual, as is Kruger, and is not interested in medium specificity, as Douglas Crimp has described, the Pictures Generation artists weren't interested in that. They were interested in the idea, first and foremost. And so Kruger insisted on simply listing the medium as photograph, rather than something more specific like silver gelatin print. And so we honored her wishes, but took the opportunity here to write a little text next to this object explaining why, as a museum, we were going to honor the artist's wishes, and that because she is self-described as a conceptual artist. So a little shift in institutional practice and an opportunity to educate the viewer. I love this work. It's so delicate, and yet it's so tough. Really, really beautiful, and giving scope to the history of artistic practice, creation, and reproduction, but also the physical and biblical sides of that story. Very, very poignant and powerful. She's an artist who, as I said earlier, works in a broad public space, and this is very important to her, both the works themselves and the places where they are made and seen are meant to be accessible on some level, and then from there you can dig down deep and arrive at more theoretical, as I have done here, or personal meaning in these works. And this work, We Don't Need Another Hero, was reproduced on a billboard in London. And the work itself is an image, a very Rockwellian image of a girl pointing at a little boy's muscle. And the phrase, "We Don't Need Another Hero," in 1986 had specific reference and relevance. It was the title of Tina Turner's song from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome that received a nomination for a Grammy Award. Unfortunately, didn't win, but it was on everyone's, everyone would have recognized that phrase at that time. So the way in which she makes her work understood in a recognizable form and then twists it and makes it complicated by pairing it with an image such as this. And she also sets it in, there's something comical about this as well as bitingly critical. And then here is the paste up in the exhibition upstairs. And it's important to show these paste ups, I felt, next to the larger works, to show Kruger's process, how she went about making these works. That in the case of Your Gaze Hits the Side of My Face was enlarged in a photographic process. This too, we take the paste up and then we go up to a different size via silk screen, which is also photographic, but it's on vinyl here. And that's in the late 80s, she started making these larger works on vinyl. And she's still working on vinyl. But the more recent works are digital prints on vinyl. So we can track the progress, technological progress of reproduction through Kruger's work in this specific era. And just to go back, I got a question the other day when giving a tour, well, what makes works that include words art? What makes them art? There's such a long history, and I could go back very far, but I decided I would just quickly run through these, examples from the past century. Picasso making these important collages that include elements of the newspaper and words, Le Journal here. There's a rich tradition, and then certainly more appropriate or connected to Kruger's practice are these Dada works, again, using collage elements and language in combination with imagery. The houseman on the left, the art critic, and the Hannah Hawk Dada Ernst collage, all from the 20s. And then, of course, my favorite, Harry mentioned, my Warhol headlines show. Warhol used text as found imagery, just like Picasso and others, and put it, elevated it to the status of art. And Warhol, among all artists, really is a favorite of Kruger's. He's the only artist she pictured or honored, in this case, at the time of his death, untimely death, in 1997 with this work. And I didn't put it in the show, but it could have qualified as a profile. So I almost, there's the ones you go back and you think, oh, I should have included that. It certainly belongs in this body of work. And then specific magazine layouts that Kruger has been commissioned to do. In this case, she's worked in many editions of Dazed and Confused, and here is a work where a woman is pictured in a mirror, looking back at the viewer, in profile, both receiving the gaze of the viewer and then, giving it back to us through the mirror, so very cheeky and subversive in many ways, and then this man who's seemingly gazing upon her, this positioning. You could go back to Goffman again and really scrutinize and analyze the structure of this layout. But this is in that case, that smaller case that I mentioned. And then Craig Owens himself, who I had mentioned, wrote The Medusa Effect, sadly died all too young at 39 in the early 90s from AIDS, and Kruger and others memorialized him in this anthology of his writings, important critic, and Kruger designed the cover for the book, Beyond Recognition, an image of a man in profile looking very carefully, forensically, at this small object, and something that I would argue Kruger herself does time and again. So they were very close colleagues and friends. And this book is in that case as well. I should mention that Kruger, I didn't show images of it. She did design book covers before she was an artist, getting more experience laying out the covers of books. And she only a few times has designed book covers as an artist, something that she very clearly differentiates from her work, commissioned work for hire. And then her op art pieces in the New York Times on the left is the blow up version of what you see on the right. It appeared in 1997. And then the way in which images in her work appear in multiple formats. So here we have the work on vinyl, and both of those examples are in the show. The New York Times op-ed pieces in the case, and then The Future Belongs to Those Who Can See It is on the large wall with the Half-Life wall mural. And she takes great pains to point out that she did not receive a fine art education, an art history education. She has no background in that, but as an artist who was growing up and teaching herself and her, and she was embedded in a cohort in New York in the 70s, and this relationship to, in this case, we can see Man Ray's surrealist photograph for certain, it is somehow through the ads that she gets this connection. She makes this connection through advertising, and we know that advertisers were drawing on the history of art very carefully and purposefully in creating their ad work. So this is an ad for, we don't know, but say Visine eye drops, and the ad person is drawing on Man Ray's photograph very beautifully. and then Kruger picks it up again and conveys it into the future. And this idea that is in her profile works repeatedly is this this return to something always being done to the eye. The eye is the agent of everything we do in our visual culture, and as she has said, a threat to the eye is a threat to what it means to live another day. So she's always calling our attention to this threat to our visual culture, the threat to the eye, and it is in several of the works in profile. And you can, it's one way to see the show, in fact, is to trace the eye. Where is the eye in the image? And it what is the eye doing in each of the images in the show? This is another example where a work, in this case, a picture is worth more than 1,000 words, is imaged on the cover of a publication, and here it is on the cover of Variety, this Los Angeles publication. Of course, a great choice for a cover, a work that references the film industry, but through, as Kruger has said, this somewhat archaic process of making films that is no longer used now that we are in the era of digital film production. And she tips, as I was talking about earlier, the orientation of the image is one way in which she reorients our understanding of our visual culture. She tips this film editor on his back. Certainly this is reoriented in some way, and then places the lettering very strategically so that it doesn't obscure the meaning, as the artist has said, of the work and her intention for it. And the phrases that she chooses again and again, a picture, you know, it's the one we're familiar with, is a picture is worth 1,000 words, and she throws this wrench into it, is worth more than 1,000 words, and really causes us to reconsider, is a picture more powerful now? Is imagery, visual imagery, more powerful and more meaningful in some ways than reading? That is, you know, reading all, like this film production means, is it becoming an archaic act? So she calls into question these very things. And in 1992, when she made this work, it may not have had the same meaning that it has today, our era of the internet and the proliferation of images on the internet. So there's a way in which her work moves forward in time, and we can derive new meaning from it. There's a fluidity there. And this really great early work, we have received orders not to move. Can't figure out what this image is from. Tried really hard to figure out what this is, but this woman who's seemingly pinned in place. And there's a cheekiness, a wittiness, and a, you know, bittersweet humor in this, certainly. And then memory is your image of perfection, this x-ray of a female figure, her face in profile, and she's wearing high heels, and we see her bracelet on her wrists and her ring. Kind of funny that she wore. And then the earliest work in the show, you thrive on mistaken identity. Again, a twist of phrases. You know, mistaken identity, we know. You thrive on mistaken identity calls into question what she's meaning here. And the profile, it's interesting to note that this is the earliest profile by Kruger, dates from 1981, and right away she is linking up the profile with identity in some way. And that, I think, is important in understanding this body of work, that the profile is understood as conveying something about identity. We understand in the history of art, in the history of culture, that the profile goes all the way back to ancient times, and the reproduction of the human head on coins, and it represented people in power, largely, the individual in power, and it was specific. It was about a specific identity of an individual, in power, profiled and in relief on coins, and Kruger captures that history, not necessarily in a purposeful way, but it somehow she gets there and draws this into this earliest, a very early work in the show, and cuts across this photograph and the olfactory senses that she's calling up in her text, cutting across the noses of the individuals in this coin and obscuring it, so creating a different meaning. I just want to go back a little bit in the history of art, and the history of the profile comes from this myth of the Corinthian maid, of which we have a picture in the West Building. It's a work that was given to us by Paul Mellon, and in which the maid profiles her sleeping lover, whose profile is depicted in shadow on the wall. And somehow that really calls into all question the idea of women representing the figure in profile. And I'm reminded that Linda Nochlin in 1971 posited that the historical practice of prohibiting women from life drawing classes ostensibly prevented them from making grand historical religious paintings, and instead their practice was contained within the so-called minor fields of portraiture, so profiles, genre, landscape, or still life. And she wrote that in an essay, an important essay, entitled Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? This example has been suggested in the history of art about the Corinthian maid and the myth of the Corinthian maid, that it belongs to this larger project of an investigation of women's drawing in the 18th and 19th century. And this is in regard to this specific work by Joseph Wright of Derby. And it interprets this much interpreted composition to address the question of art's origins and purposes, and shows how meaning, art historians have showed how meaning is depended on the viewer's ideological position in regard to women artists, the hierarchy of genres, and the status of the fine arts in a commercial economy. So seemingly related to Kruger's project with her profile works. And then I just wanted to talk about a work by an essay by Patricia Simons, in which she describes the profile in Renaissance portraiture and how it related in a different way to the understanding of identity. Specific identity and portraits were done of the betrothed of an important patron. And that this was meant as marriage, a gift, in a wedding gift to the patron. So ideals about feminine beauty conveyed about specific people. And interestingly, Patricia Simon does call up Kruger's work, Your Gaze Hits the Side of My Face, in her discussion of this body of work. And then just the playfulness in Kruger's work. As Harry had mentioned, I had the great pleasure of working with Barbara. She is she has perfect pitch in regard to space and design, and it was such an honor, and it was so much fun. She's a lot of fun, as is her work. But to actually install the show with her and to make my suggestions and then have her come in and come up with some things that I never would have either had taken the liberty to do or had the idea even to do. And this work, Love is Something You Fall Into, is a great example of that, where she put it up at the top of the ceiling, at the top of the wall, and created a negative space and really used the tower space in a way it has never been used before, both with the large monumental wall work, Half-Life, and Love is Something You Fall Into, being up at the top of that wall, that south wall. And giving us a different understanding of space and relationship between images, these two figures, you know, laying on their backs but reoriented and almost talking to one another, this conversation that they're having, very playful, very much activated in a new and wonderful way. And the tower has never had such a treatment before, so this show is unique in that regard. And then lastly, just the viewer experience has been really phenomenal to look online to see how people are positioning themselves in relationship to Kruger's work and what they decide to picture and repicture online via Instagram. In this case, this is just a snapshot of the many images that are on Instagram. And we've also had some great comments coming through from the public about the relationship of the work to the present and various examples and various ways in which it's relevant for them or relevant in certain instances. And I can't say enough about Barbara Kruger. She is a phenomenal artist, but she is very very committed to her pedagogy. She is a teacher. Importantly, she chose not to give a public lecture, so that's why I'm here. but she instead has chosen to do a project with Title I high school art students at the National Gallery that we're organizing. And I think that is really meaningful. And we're also, that is happening in December, and working with our education department, that the artist will come and meet with students who have already been working on and visiting her show. And the other part is, you may see, and I've made some reference to, her interest in film. And she has selected 4 films that will be shown in December as part of a special program called Barbara Kruger Selects. And we're very pleased to have that in conjunction with this exhibition that really rounds out the way she looks at our visual culture. She remains a devoted so-called news junkie. She watches, as I mentioned, she is an anthropologist of our visual culture. She is very interested in television. She loves the Real Housewives series, apparently, and gains a lot of information for her work through those programs. She's someone who is working at the very height of her powers, and we have a retrospective of her work to look forward to. We'll be at the Art Institute of Chicago in 2020, so we can all look forward to that. And I think that's about it for now. I leave you with just this parting shot of the public take on Kruger and its position in our visual world and the proliferation of images across the internet. And her work seems almost uniquely suited for this purpose. So many works are well suited, but this work conveys so clearly and so boldly her ideas for it, that it does indeed grab the attention of the viewer and at once arrests the viewer's attention to stop and think about some of the types that she's presenting in the images and in the language she chooses to use in her work. You may be able to tell. I had a lot of fun putting this together, and it was a great pleasure, and I'm grateful for it. So thank you for coming.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.